paper that I have that was that had the most citations was with Ernie, of course. Yeah. So.
Yeah. There will be some people here who do not know who Ernie Abel is, but. Let's see, let me start checking off names here. Leah, you look very comfortable. Oh, your other picture went away.
Now you look uncomfortable.
Did I see Jennifer or no? Yeah, there she is.
I'm here. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good afternoon.
Dr. Jones, how are you today?
I'm okay, Ed. How are you?
I'm hanging in there. Hey, you guys got any pictures of strange lip shapes?
Strange lip shapes.
Yeah, that you might be useful in diagnosing FAS.
I don't know of any.
I think you and Miguel have pointed out, you know, like a lack of the Cupid's bow and.
Oh yeah.
I think you've mentioned other things as well. So.
Well, the philtrum. One of the things that Miguel and I think Miguel actually brought this up first, is that we see a number of kids, I shouldn't say a lot, but we see a number of kids in which the philtrum is completely smooth in the upper half, and then it's normal down below. And what that means in terms of diagnosis.
If you have any of those pictures that you're able to share, I would appreciate.
Okay. Miguel, right. We can come up with some pictures, can't we?
Yes. Well, I have maybe 60 of them from Spain, but they're all Russians.
Well, they're none identifiable because I only want from the nose. You know, to the...
No, I understand. I understand. I'm just saying it's not diverse from the ethnic.
Well, that's okay. We're the ethnic ones we're dealing with another way, I think.
Yeah. So, yes, I mean, I've never taken a systematic approach to classifying the different shapes, you know, but it's certainly something we could think of.
I've been doing a lot of reading and thinking, so. Mm-hmm. And having lots of other issues in my life, but other than that, so let's see, Scott's there, I think. Yep. Jeff on.
Yep.
Johan. Christine Austin. Sarah. Tatiana. Leah's there. Tina there. Thought I saw Tina.
I'm here.
All right, Christine Austin's there. Raj, Mike Suddy's there, Susan Smith's there, Tom Donaldson's there, maybe, yep. Kathy Mitchell, John Hannigan, Dan. Yeah. Joe Wang's not gonna be there today, Sarah Joe. And Elizabeth Powell's here. All right, so we can get going. A couple of things is for you in the field, everyone should know the name, but Ernie Abel passed away
On
Saturday.
Really?
Yeah.
Of what?
Yeah.
Of what, do you know?
Pancreatic cancer.
Oh no.
So Ernie was one of the original people in the field, probably has written as much as anybody on it. And he was a friend and a colleague, and he will be one of the most unique I'm not sure the right how you described his depth of interest. A true Renaissance individual who wrote on everything from the Civil War to fetal alcohol. And he was just a very interesting character who made lots of contributions to the field. And, started out with prenatal marijuana, where you used to buy marijuana on the streets of Toronto and or Montreal, I forget which, and
Toronto.
Have subjects come in and smoke and wrote us stuff before they had IRBs and before marijuana was legal anywhere. But so he was a creative, interesting man. I think Christine Austin was on the line. She made the Apple News today in an article in Vox, I believe that's her. On the use of baby teeth and assessing them for exposure to stress and toxins. And so that was good to read this morning when I woke up. And it's something I think that hopefully will be moving forward in this field. So there are my two announcements. The agenda for today is to kind of go over the one slide that people prepared to describe their accomplishment or their latest findings or their most interesting finding in CFAS-4. And it's primarily self-serving in that what I'm been trying to do is to put together the presentation that I'll have to do for the reverse site visit for CFAS-5. And so what I wanted to get was an idea of what you felt was a major accomplishment that you've achieved and how you describe it. And what I was looking for was a simple way to describe a lot of science. You know, I have a very limited time and I can't highlight everything that everybody has done, but it's really the only chance that we'll get at the reverse site visit to highlight our big aims. And you have to remember that the reviewers are going to be from a diverse population, considering that how diverse CFAS-5 will be. And so it has to be in a language that all the reviewers are going to understand. So what I was hoping to do was to go through those slides so that I'm sure that I understand them and can explain them in a simple way. So it's really to acquaint everybody here with what each project feels is its outstanding contribution or future project, and that I understand it and hopefully can present it at the reverse site visit in an easy to understand way to this very diverse group of reviewers. But we have no idea who they are yet. They won't let us know until 30 days prior to the meeting. And they haven't told me how much time I will have, but I believe last time was somewhere between 20 minutes and 30 minutes. So that's to overview basically CFAS 4 and the new CFAS-5. So that's my hope today, is that we can do it and go through it and everyone will walk away with a better understanding of what everybody else has done. Can understand it in simple terms. So does that make sense? any questions about that, and appreciate it, your help on doing this. So there's really no particular order, but Jill sent one out, so
she did.
Good by me.
Okay.
And you know, we may have to modify some of the slides because some of the stuff is a little complicated to present to reviewers and hard to read even in screen mode here. So, all right, Ken and Miguel. Miguel, you'll be the one who's the PI on this. So if you can
go
through what we have here, and then if you have any questions.
So I would say, obviously, the main task of the dysmorphology core has been to classify and diagnose all the research subjects across many studies. In order to expand the diagnostic capacity, we felt that the use of telemedicine would be necessary. And we then had to prove that we would be able to use telemedicine to reliably identify the physical features, both of us, and to actually try to measure the concordance or the agreement between what we would be able to examine face to face and what we would be able to examine through telemedicine. Interestingly, this study that we performed in 61 patients also made us compare how two different examiners that are knowledgeable about the condition can disagree in some of the features and to what extent. So for the study, we used two telemedicine systems, one very complex and costly, a telemedicine station that we call TESS, and one that was basically an iPhone at the examiner's end and an iPad at the receiver's end, and just using Zoom teleconferencing, which is what later has been used clinically due to the COVID epidemic. So, and we basically compared the agreement for all the features, and the agreements were all measured as coefficient, where most of them in the almost perfect range, some of them in the substantial range at 0.7 or 0.6 for some of the other secondary features. So the upper figure describes the agreement for the primary features, obviously the weight and so the growth is measured objectively. So for the head, the agreement was complete. And for the philtrum and vermilion, it was in the perfect range, but it's true that we had close to a millimeter disagreement for the palpable fissures, which was in only in the substantial agreement range. For some of the other features, as I said, and this is, for example, a fact of very low numbers, but most of them were also in the almost perfect range. However, not a perfect agreement. What we did see when we compared the two telemedicine techniques, they were very similar. And when we tried to see whether the differences we had were more related to our differences in assessing the feature rather than the distortion that the technique would cause, we could see that they were related to our differences in assessing the features. So basically the results of the study were that yes, telemedicine is a reliable way to assess these features. We did define the techniques such as the distance from the examiner, the type of lighting, and how those things could make the exam more valid, more accurate. But we also realize that we need, in order to agree more, we need more precision in measurement and more objectivity. So this is, in a way, the introduction to the need to use more precise and objective tools, such as Morpheus-Q, that would provide a more precise way to measure the popular fishers, and probably a more objective and accurate way to assess the filtrum and the upper lip through a continuous scale. And this is what we will try to develop first with preliminary data and then in CFAS-5 in terms of expanding our diagnostic capacity, not only assessing patients, evaluating patients through telemedicine, but also training other physicians through telemedicine to evaluate patients through telemedicine. So
all right.
Yeah.
On the top graph, you have two measures for filtrum and two for vermilion. What's the difference?
Two measures for filtrum and two for vermilion.
I mean, so the last, you have four. I can't show you, but on the four.
Can we zoom in on that?
No, on the.
We actually have three, okay, for each. And one is the, the agreement between the examiner and himself.
Yeah, no, I understand that. I'm looking at the legend on the, across the x-axis.
On the x-axis.
Oh, yeah, filtrum, and I can't read what it says.
Filtrum vermilion, sorry. This is just a positive feature. So that is
smooth. Go to the top one.
Yes.
Go to the top graph. That's FAS diagnosis.
Yes.
Head circumference, papilleal fissure length.
Yes.
Filtrum something.
No. Vermilion. Okay. So let me tell you. So filtrum sign, meaning the filtrum is smooth, 4 or 5. The vermilion is smooth, 4 or 5. And here the agreement applies to the actual number. So in the first one, in the first two, the feature is just considered negative below 4 and positive 4 or 5, okay, for filtrum and vermilion, and that's the agreement. And these two is the specific agreement for the number.
Okay.
So you got it? Yeah.
Yeah. And so the zoom on papilleal fissure length seems to be better than anything else.
Yes. So I mean, what these comparisons are is, the very dark black is me with myself doing it twice in person, face to face.
Right.
And then the other two is one of my exams, my first exam, compared to the exam that Ken is performing and I am evaluating through Zoom and with Tess.
Yeah.
So interestingly, I agreed with Ken's evaluation more when we use Zoom than when we use Tess. Mm-hmm. As you can imagine, this refers to a couple of measures and a couple of patients. So I am not sure that means Zoom is much better than Tess, but it is true that we had a lot of difficulty focusing with this very complex system with the camera. Mm-hmm. So it was much more difficult to be able to place it at the right distance, whatever. Whereas for the papilleal fissures, the iPad and iPhone seem to work perfectly. So at least what it means is that the Zoom system, the handheld devices, is as good as the other, so we can forget about this costly telemedicine station.
Have you done this between an expert and someone who's not another expert?
No.
All right. Any other questions? Okay.
Elizabeth
has her hand up.
Oh, I'm sorry. I don't have my... Elizabeth.
Yeah, so maybe this is just me being fussy or dumb, but these values are concordance rates, so they shouldn't be connected, right? Shouldn't this really be a bar graph? I mean, I feel that
Okay. That's perfectly licit. And in fact, in the paper, we ended up we ended up putting the table, not any of the graphs. But I do have the bar graph, the graph, and I can change it if you feel that's more.
Yeah, I was going to ask you to change the graph and to make the captions a little bit larger because so that they could be seen by the reviewers if this one gets used.
Okay.
Thank you.
And there's also a comment there from Leah. So, all right, Joanne.
Okay. Can I use my cursor? Can people see my cursor or no? You have control of the screen.
Yeah, Jill has control.
Okay. All right. I'll just talk. Okay. So the question we asked here was, can circulating cytokines serve as a biomarker of alcohol exposure and child neurodevelopmental status? And the children we examined were part of Tina's longitudinal cohort study in Ukraine, where women were recruited over a period of years and children were selected from this overall cohort. And the measures we used were child neurodevelopment as assessed at 6 and 12 months with the Bayleys. And a blood sample was taken at 2 to 3.5 years at a second follow-up visit. And we got blood samples from those kids and the Bayley information and so on. I worked with Tina and her team to analyze the data. So the groups were stratified by both maternal alcohol exposure or by whether or not the child was exposed to alcohol and the child developmental status. So the first two columns here are control children born to women who consumed low to no levels of alcohol during pregnancy. And of those children, many were typically developing, but there was a subset that showed delayed development, not due to alcohol. The alcohol exposed children are shown in the third and fourth columns. Again, many of them showed delay, but a subset of them were typically developing. And what we did was analyze not only by individual cytokines, but we did an analysis to identify networks of interacting cytokines, which is how cytokines act. And so our networks are shown in the three rows. The top row is a network that is a signature of alcohol dependent or independent delay. The second row is a network that's a signature of resilience. And the third row is a network that provides a signature of alcohol exposure. So we had four cytokines acted together in a network in the first network. And those four cytokines are shown across the four groups. And if you look at the color of the little circle, we have low exposure and light, low levels of expression in the light colors, high levels of cytokine expression in the dark colors. So let me just describe the networks briefly because that's the bottom line of what we found. I'm going to start at the bottom with network three. And there you see that for children who are exposed to alcohol, those three cytokines had a very high level of expression compared to the low level of expression in the control children, regardless of developmental outcome. So network three, those three cytokines are a signature of whether or not the child was exposed to alcohol. Network two in the middle are five cytokines. And this is a network that signals resilience. So here, look at the two squares with cytokines within them. And you can see there that the pattern of cytokine expression is opposite in alcohol exposed children who are typically developing compared to alcohol exposed children who show delay. So the pattern of cytokine expression can distinguish whether or not the child is typically developing or shows delay in all those children exposed to alcohol. And the top network is a network of alcohol dependent or independent delay. So here, the second column and the fourth column are compared. And you can see that the level of cytokine expression in control children who show delay is very high. And those same four cytokines have a very low level of expression in alcohol exposed children who show delay. So for example, if you had a child who is identified as having developmental delay, the pattern of cytokine expression can tell you whether or not that delay was due to alcohol. So the promise of this, of these data, is the possibility to use cytokines or immune markers as biomarkers that not only can identify alcohol exposure, but could also predict developmental delay in these kids.
Right. Now, Joanna, I'm not an immunologist or cytokine expert by any means.
Correct.
But that the chart, the graph, or the lines up on the top from point zero, minus 0.4 to plus 0.4. So what's the difference between the minus, is zero?
Ignore the number. This just shows you the range of cytokine expression that we captured in the assay. The light colors mean it's very low levels of expression, and the dark colors mean it's a high level of expression.
Right, it's, but I didn't understand.
What's the magnitude of the difference from top to bottom?
All right, so when I think that, well, that they're not being expressed, that's...
They all are being expressed. At a level that they can be assayed, but the expression level can be low or high.
Okay, I just didn't get the minus relative to zero.
Okay, ignore the numbers. I can delete the numbers out of there. It's just a gradation to tell you that what the cytokine, the color of the cytokine represents if it's a high level of expression or a low level.
Okay, so it's not relative. It's not relative to the typical person then.
This is just an assay of cytokine, an assay of blood that measures cytokines that are expressed at a high level or a low level. The same four cytokines are shown in the four groups.
Yeah, I just didn't, when the typicals were all basically white circles, and I'm trying to figure out, you know.
There, the network wasn't indicative particularly of typical development. But the key point here is that of the children who show delayed development, you have an opposite pattern of expression.
Okay.
Controls versus alcohol exposed.
Gotcha.
So what I've outlined in the light blue are the comparisons that are critical for that row.
Yeah, no, I got that. I was just within the circles. I understand that there are different levels of expression. I just didn't understand the relationship to the white circle, which, you know, I would have, there's not a depression in expression in any of these. All right.
I could redo it and just show the comparisons that we want to make.
That's fine. I mean, I just got confused with the negatives.
Right.
Relative to zero, you know, that's all.
Joanne, it's Michael, just a really quick, again, for legibility, and I appreciate if this is difficult. It's hard to read the names of the cytokines.
Correct.
That are the oldest. Yeah. And I know sometimes when you make them bigger, then they, you know, they get screwed up in their placement and everything. But if there's a way to make them bigger, it would be easier for people to see which ones.
All right. Let me try to do that. Part of the point of this is it's not the particular cytokine that's critical here. It's that you have an interacting network of cytokines, and they might be chemokines or angiogenesis markers. So the exact cytokine that we're representing here is not critical. In the manuscript, we discuss specific cytokines and what their low or high level of expression might mean. The point to make here is that it's the pattern that differs.
I do appreciate that, but as soon as you see, ooh, this one is associated with resilience, and the delayed has an elevated CRP, which is a nice inflammatory marker, you can start to sort of formulate your own hypotheses just looking at them and, you know, knowing a little bit about the cytokines. So I think for people who want to know more at a glance, it's nice just to be able to read them.
Okay.
I appreciate, you know, that it really is about
the
concern.
That's a fair point. I'll redo it so that the cytokines are more visible.
Thanks, Joanne.
Okay.
All right, Claire.
Oh, okay. Are you putting up the slide? Okay. Basically, this is just a very quick overview of the adult project. And the hypothesis of that, of course, was that there'll be increased health and mental health problems in middle adulthood among alcohol-exposed individuals. And our results were, in fact, that health and mental health issues associated with PAE probably result from the effects of heightened stress on the organism made vulnerable by PAE. You'll see that, and again, there's a great deal of data in this, and I had to condense it, but physical health was reported to be less good among those who were alcohol exposed. And across a number of mental health issues, alcohol exposed individuals reported a higher incidence of mental health issues. In order to really sort this out in a meaningful way, we did path analyses in order to indicate the role of the various factors which might influence these outcomes. And we chose here thyroid disorder and depression symptoms simply because they were representative of health and mental health. And we included a number of factors which we thought might predict issues, and one, age, the sex, the biological sex of the individual, prenatal alcohol exposure, the site where these data were collected, either Atlanta or Seattle, the social economic status of the individual based on the Hollingshead criteria. We also looked at the adverse childhood experiences reported by the individuals. We looked at physical dysmorphology, and then of course E is error. We found that in both cases, both physical and mental health issues, that we found a relationship with prenatal alcohol exposure that was typically an indirect relationship, and it was usually modified through various environmental stressors, social class, adverse childhood experiences, and often through biological sex. In some cases, we found that dysmorphology was a modifier as well. So what we gather from all this is that prenatal alcohol exposure has long-term effects on outcome, and this is regularly reported by individuals across all walks of life in different locations. But we believe that it is in many cases, the outcomes are in many cases mediated by the environmental experiences the individual has postnatally. This is about as fast as I can get through it.
I got a question. The physical health, these are the percent that are reporting that?
It's percent who are reporting it.
All right, so and the up above you said multiple health and mental health problems.
Yep.
And so it really looks like the controls have more, yes, I have a physical problem.
I have to put that in differently.
It looks backwards that the alcohol people have less physical health problems.
The question here was, are you in good health?
Yeah, see, but the caption above says multiple health and mental health problems. And I'm looking and saying, whoa.
Yep. Very good point. I'll modify that and send it.
Thank you. The path analysis, I mean, you can't really read them.
No, you can't really read it.
So I'm not sure how we'd deal with that, but
I wonder if there's another way to capture that.
So,
well, I don't think we can. I was trying to do it as graphically as possible, but I don't know how to do that. How to put a path analysis in that isn't. I mean, we could put just one big one in, but then I have to leave off the rest of it.
Can you put I think you can construct without a formal path analysis with all the lines, but you know, simply showing the list you have in the middle is influencing those outcomes, and you know, both stress and alcohol exposure influencing both outcomes in midlife. I think that's the summary you want to focus on.
Do you think I should just take out the actual path analysis and put in a graph?
I would. I think it's more distracting than anything, actually.
Okay. Yeah. I'll make another slide that has that.
All righty. Any other?
Just a quick observation, which is that there's an emerging literature and a few really good papers showing that if you follow veterans who have PTSD longitudinally, that they have accelerated atherosclerosis, increased blood pressure, and a lot of the same things that you're finding in your studies. So there's a sort of an adult homologue of this, which is the effect of stress on accelerated aging, if you will.
Yeah, I think we're talking about that. But what I think is going on is that the early exposure, the alcohol exposure, is the initial stressor. And then it causes vulnerability to the future stressors.
Yeah. So the path analysis really helps to show that. I mean, you could, in a sense, line up your two graphs on the left, top to bottom, and then increase the size of the path analysis on the right and put a graph
just
above.
Just put one in. Okay, yeah. I'll rearrange and come up with something.
Yeah, and maybe you don't need all of the chi-square results laid out just to say they're significant or.
Yeah, I could do that.
Yeah.
Yeah. All righty. Jeff. And then Sarah will be after that.
All right. So CFAST has allowed us to learn about many of the neurologic anomalies that come with prenatal alcohol exposure. So we know that alcohol is a dirty drug and interferes with development in many different forms and at many different stages of development. We see a lot of variety in how the brain looks across the spectrum of FASD. So these are just a few examples of the kind of work that we've been doing to characterize specifics that we see in FASD. And if you can't see the letters here, somehow they changed colors. Okay. Well, the figure with the four brains in it is diffusion tensor imaging data. So this is our white matter measure that is showing a clear abnormality in the development of the white matter. And this is something that we expect happens over time because these are fibers that are moving during the developmental phase into the hemispheres. And so you can see in the back part of the colorful image in the four panel there, that there's an anomaly in the way that those fibers have moved into position. Another angle that we are taking is trying to understand the cortex and what goes wrong in cortical development. And so we're looking here at the depth and the definition of the sulci and gyri. And the figure on the bottom left, the colorful map overlaid on the brain, is a statistical, the intensity of the colors are a statistical representation showing you where we see the most cortical anomaly in terms of this folding pattern. So it's a little bit easier to just look at the graph D, and this is mean gyrification across the whole cortex. So this is now asking the question, how smooth is the cortex versus how convoluted and well folded is it? And when we do a simple correlation with IQ, you can see this includes all of our participants, alcohol exposed and controls. And there's a pretty significant correlation, pretty significant association between the overall level of that cortical folding and the resulting IQ in that child. So how does this lead into the next phase, and what is, how is this important? Well, we now have methods, various methods, that we can stimulate cortex. And there's now an expanding literature across all kinds of developmental fields showing that when you stimulate parts of the cortex, even with mild stimulation, something like we're using here in the picture, which is labeled F, if you're doing something relevant, in this case, this child's doing cognitive training, so doing computerized exercises, visually stimulating, video game-like paradigms that are training memory, concentration, processing speed. If you're stimulating brain at the same time, cortex, in this case, we're stimulating, you enhance the results of that cognitive training. So we've done a pilot study. The figure on the right with the blue and red bars or blue and red lines show over the course of 5 trials of this combined dual mode therapy, cognitive training and stimulation, there's a separation in the groups. These were randomized groups, about 20 kids each. And this is sustained attention is what we're looking at here, distractibility. And you can see that over the course of those 5 sessions, that there's a separation and the group that's getting the stimulation does better, makes more gains in their working memory ability, their sustained attention, than the group that is not being stimulated. So that's the idea for the next phase, is to take what we've learned about cortical development and cortical anomalies to try to apply this intervention, that's a dual mode intervention, and to really understand what are the parameters under which this will work with FASD. For example, there may be some children whose cortex is normal, and there may be some children whose cortical development was so abnormal that they're not going to benefit from an intervention like this. So that's part of how we're going to blend these two lines of research together in the next phase. We're going to continue to do imaging in a subset. We're going to do this randomized controlled trial, and we're going to learn a lot about how to shape this intervention as we move forward.
Righty. I put pretty clear that, you know, maybe you want to make some labels on the graphs a little bigger and.
Yeah, there were like letters on each one, and somehow they've disappeared on your version, or they've changed colors. So
that I'm not so worried about. It's just, you know, maybe my vision's going bad, or I need my other glasses. But that's a little better. All right. Well, Sarah, because I don't want to run out of time before we get through everybody.
What I'm trying to portray here is just sort of the main findings that we have from CFAS-4. As you know, we collected data from multiple sources. We have the research participants were evaluated with physical exams, parent questionnaires, in-person neuropsychological testing, and online neuropsychological testing. The two main tools that we've developed are the FASD tree and Brain Online. And FASD tree has two components. It has the decision tree component, which results in a sort of dichotomous outcome, yes or no, and the risk score outcome, which outputs a risk score ranging from 0 to 5. We looked at the we have previously developed these measures in previous phases of CFAS, and using CFAS-4 data, we looked at overall accuracy and various validity measures of the two components, the decision tree and the risk score, as well as their combination. All three analyses were highly significant. Both the indicators and their combination were highly significant in their ability to identify individuals who were suspected of having an FASD. And we also know that it's not on this slide, but the outcome of the FASD tree relates to in-person neuropsychological testing. So people who
come up with an FASD positive result on the FASD tree have worse neuropsychological outcomes than people who come up with a negative outcome on the, or negative meaning not FASD, on the FASD tree. The outcome also relates to ARND diagnosis. That's not on this slide either. The other main outcome is the development of Brain Online, which is a series of seven neuropsychological tests and a very brief behavioral screen. And we were able to deploy this task starting about the beginning of the pandemic and have collected, actually don't know the exact number, in the low 100s number of participants on this test. We're still continuing to collect. And the outcome of Brain Online shows us that we can distinguish people with histories of prenatal alcohol exposure from controls on almost nearly all of the measures, as well as the behavioral screen, which is just a 12-item screening tool. And we're looking at now at the relationship between Brain Online and in-person neuropsychological testing, and our preliminary analysis suggests that there are strong relationships there.
And my only comment is it's a lot hard to read anything on the slide.
Okay.
Me anyway. I don't know.
Yeah. I wonder if you could make the your decision tree graphics smaller and then actually make some of, maybe either just select some of the Brain Online so that it's large enough to be viewed.
So the, really, okay, I'm sorry, Jen, I missed. So do you, yeah, it is definitely small. I agree. Those are actually full slides on their own. So making Brain Online larger and reducing the left-hand panel of the slide.
Oh, well, the decision tree part of it, the visual graphic part, again, you can't really see what it is. So mm-hmm. I don't know that it adds much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I got a very limited time, so I can't really, things that are self-explanatory are probably going to make the cut, where things that are require lots of explanation are probably not going to get placed in the overview. So
if there's any specific suggestions, I'm very happy to make changes. Just let me know. I mean, I feel like I'm condensing.
You are. There's a lot. And that's why, you know, I wanted to go over this so that people would see what the reviewers are going to see with what we have now without changing anything. And and see, you know, if you were a reviewer looking at this, it would take you a lot of time to get all to try to comprehend what's going on. So maybe an example like Jennifer just mentioned, you know, a couple examples, and increasing the font in the boxes would help.
Okay, okay, all right.
So, all right, we can move on. Tina?
All right, so this is the Ukraine Clinical Project, which is a prospective cohort study conducted in two regions in Western Ukraine. Where pregnant women were recruited who either had moderate to heavy levels of prenatal alcohol exposure, or comparison women, pregnant women who had low or no alcohol exposure, and their live-born children were followed for neurodevelopment, physical features of FASD, and growth. One of the primary aims in CFAS for the Ukraine Clinical Project was to identify early biomarkers of exposure, and most particularly early biomarkers of affected children that might lead to opportunities for early intervention. So two that were highlighted on this slide are the cardiac orienting response on the left and microRNA expression in children as biomarkers of exposure or effect. So for cardiac orienting response, this analysis was led by Julie Cable at Emory University. And what the paradigm is a child is presented with an auditory or a visual stimulus And in the several seconds following the presentation of the stimulus, heart rate is monitored to look at the neurophysiological encoding of environmental events, so how the child is responding to the stimulus. And so these children, 120 in total, with and without prenatal alcohol exposure, were evaluated at 6 or 12 months using this cardiac orienting response. And then those same children were evaluated at preschool age, 3 to 5 years, with a neurobehavioral testing battery, and they had a physical exam as well. And what we found in using a sort of a risk score based on deviation from the mean for typical heart rate in this sample in the cardiac oriented response was that the responses on this assessment in infancy were predictive, significantly predictive following a visual stimulus of partial FAS or FAS. So that looking at the right panel, you can see on the visual side, if I had the cursor, that FAS, PFAS was significantly predicted by this risk score on the cardiac orienting response. We did not see the same significant association with what was classified as ARND or unexposed. But the area under the curve for FAS and PFAS was 0.77, so suggesting that this may be a good screening tool for young infants for having an affected child that might not be recognized until much later. On the right side of the panel, Rajesh Miranda, a co-investigator from Texas A&M, has been working with us on microRNAs for several years. These are important molecules because they represent the sum total of secretory activity of cells and tissues throughout the body, so they really reflect overall health. And they're useful predictive markers. So they changes in these would typically precede a physiologic outcome. And they are functional endocrine molecules, so they are potential targets for intervention. So we had previously shown that 11 microRNAs that were altered in expression in mothers with prenatal alcohol exposure during pregnancy were predictive of having an affected child. So we followed in CFAS-4 with this finding, wanting to look at were there alterations in microRNA expression in children. So we had 57 children in about the preschool age range for which we had plasma samples. And we found that plasma samples from children with evidence for neurodevelopmental delay exhibited a preferential elevation in levels of microRNAs compared to non-affected comparison children. And that's shown in the right side of the panel here, showing the volcano plot for neurodevelopmental status. We found less of an association with microRNA alterations in the predicting prenatal alcohol exposure status. However, nine of the microRNAs that were differentially expressed in these children overlapped with those that were differentially expressed in the maternal samples for children who ultimately had neurodevelopmental delay. And we think that these data indicate that prenatal alcohol exposure that results in neurodevelopmental delay also results in dysregulation of child plasma microRNAs measured at this young age. So this biomarker of affected children may also be important in terms of identifying children who would benefit from early intervention.
Any questions, or is it pretty clear? Okay.
Christine, Tina, is there are the colors on the left just referring to the magnitude of effect?
Yes, you're talking about on the cardiac orienting response?
No. On the neurodevelopmental status. Yes. On the volcano plot.
Yeah, okay. The blue is moderate association and the orange is stronger.
Okay. I like your x-axis, the increase in delay and increase in normal. I think that's something that other people can maybe look at because it really illustrates nicely what you're looking at. Because the other writing is very small and hard to read.
We only have about 10 minutes left, or if that, maybe only 5. So I'd like to get through at least one more, and then people can stay on or people can leave. And if they have to, Mike? Mike Suddy, you there? Did he have to leave, Jill?
I don't know. I'll go to the next slide.
Okay. Tatiana or Leo?
Mike, you're on. Why is this? Muted.
Oh, is Mike? Mike, you want to go? You want me to go ahead?
No, no.
Go ahead, Mike. Mike,
not there.
You're muted or something. We can't hear you. All right. Leah?
Okay. I think the biggest take-home message from our study is that even though pre-COVID we did everything online, we thought we would get a nice good sample size, we don't have enough to do any kind of discovery genetic analysis. So what we will do with all of our money is to get whole exome sequencing data on more than 700 people, all of them with prenatal alcohol exposure. This will be rare functional variants. And all of these 713 people will also be submitted to obtain genome-wide association study data. And then we can combine that with other data from phase 2 and 3 of CFAST. And that should give us close to 1,200 people with GWAS data. We'll clean it, we'll have it ready to share with other people. And a couple of good things about these data is that it's actually the largest sample. There are a few smatterings of publications of genetic studies of people with prenatal alcohol exposure, but this is by far the largest. And it's the only study that has sequencing data on all the exomes.
Do you already have all 713 collected?
No.
But you're hoping to by the end?
Yes, I think we have about 500 now.
Okay, I was thinking that was a lot more than I heard last time.
Any other questions? If people have to drop off, Scott, Susan, Mike, is he back or not? All right, Mike, I'm sorry, Scott, you and Joe, Johan? I'll come back to Christy because she's got two in a row.
Sure, ours was pretty simple and just kept it to our most recent paper. In this paper, we knocked out P53 in both mice and fish and showed that we can protect against the effects of alcohol. We can reduce apoptosis and protect against the effects of alcohol, and that this is a conserved pathway in both mice and zebrafish. And further points to the pathways that I didn't show here, but that Johan and I have been kind of focusing on for most of the past 4.5 years. And Johan, do you have anything to add?
No, very well said.
This was a rather simple slide, and thanks for the clarification, Johan, that I asked for.
Sure.
Any questions? Okay. Christy, are you still on?
Yep, I'm still here.
All right, you want to do at least the U01?
Sure. I tried to keep this relatively visually simple. So this study, we have used a systematic developmental evaluation approach to develop and test a caregiver intervention using mobile health applications. This is called the Families Moving Forward Connect app. We began in 2017 and 18 with focus groups to inform development of the app. We then sequentially moved to two rounds of beta testing once we had initial prototypes developed of both iOS and Android. This, we used qualitative focus groups and interviews to gain feedback, and also looked at user analytic data. This study showed high acceptability from families and gave us initial ideas of some additional refinements to improve functionalities. In 2020 and 2021, we conducted a feasibility trial, which larger scale. I think I'm going to add sample size numbers to this one to kind of help if additional detail is useful. But again, testing, not only continue to test the app in terms of its functionality and how the user experience is for families, but also looking in this trial at some of the structural logistics for a larger scale trial, such as are the measures sensitive to change? Is the recruitment process feasible and achieve a sufficient sample? And all of those pieces in that feasibility trial have been instrumental in preparing for the randomized control trial that is currently ongoing right now. And here's a mock-up of the part. What you can see on the side is the interface and the learning modules for the app, and pointing to some of the other core features. And overall, our data so far has shown it to be feasible and acceptable for families. It has great potential to being scalable and reducing some barriers to care.
Okay. We're basically out of time, and we have the UH2s just to discuss. So we'll figure that out. And so I'm sorry to the UH2 investigators that we've kind of run out of time and people are dropping off. And Michael had to leave, and so did Elizabeth Powell. I don't know how much time I'm going to have, and Michael and I are going to split the time, and Michael's going to talk about the science moving forward and perhaps some of the progress, and I'm going to present the overall kind of CFAS approach. I know that Jill soliciting information from you on new investigators brought into the field and diversity, which are issues that I have to discuss. So there's not going to be a lot of time to go over things. We will have to select and pick which projects we're going to highlight. I don't want anyone to feel bad if we don't highlight your project. It's just a matter of timing issue and the number of slides. Christy asked if I could present multiple slides for a project, and I probably could. I have not been given any guidance whatsoever yet on the presentation, but from the last one, you know, they were limited. We were limited the number of people that we could have. I don't think we have that problem this time. I think Jill sent out what I know about the reverse site visit. The reverse site visit will be my opening presentation with Michael, and then questions to PIs to clarify points that they have. They usually get together the night before and come up with a series of questions, and some people may get questions, other people may not. Why I think the only time we really get to show or highlight anything is during that maybe 20 to 30 minutes that I have. You will probably be able to use PowerPoints to clarify questions, so you should, you know, prepare them. And I'm reading some of the notes here. And I agree. So simple, you know, is better, I think, in this case. And it's basically that, you know, you're going to have two people who have read your grant, maybe three, and but everybody gets to vote. So I want to try to make it as clear to everybody as possible. Sarah, Joe, and then John.
Well, John had his hand up first, and he's
I know. Over. John, go ahead.
I just wanted to emphasize some of what the chat conversation has already brought up. I thought overall the slides had way too much information on them, very much too much text. I think it was very valuable today because you're explaining to Ed, you know, what the key points are. He's only going to have a snapshot of what you presented. If there's some explanatory material that you have on a slide, drop it down into a note that Ed can still see. That would be useful to him. But very much so, you know, when you have a word that's on there as a label, those are much too small, and really work hard to take out text and extraneous information. That you know, if I'm sitting for even for just 20 or 30 minutes and trying to encapsulate 5 years worth of progress report, I want the snapshot. And let's, I think you have to work much harder, all of you, to make that easier for Ed to get across.
Yeah. I perhaps wasn't clear, you know, about the one slide or what I wanted, but or what I needed, but I have an idea now and going on. Sarah Jo?
So they, the groups will largely not have any conversation until the morning thereof. They will bring their notes and their questions, and then they'll talk amongst themselves and assign that out. So basically, the person and others who are assigned to yours are going to identify two or three questions that they will hold should they need them. And Ed, you guys are going to have probably just like you said, 20 to 30 minutes. Usually that time can be spent however the director feels is appropriate. So whatever you want to do in large part. And then the rest of it is questions to people. So they, you know, they're cutting down the length of time that it requires to do them. But also, while everybody will not have read all of that, many of them will have read all of the aims for all of the projects and will be looking to see how those build on and integrate.
Sarah Jo has chaired several of these, so she's got some familiarity. Dan?
And then yeah, Dan. I was just going, I concur with both Sarah and John's comments. I think it's going to be really important to find out as soon as possible exactly how you think the reverse site visit will be run, because you know, my last experience from almost 4 years ago was that we were allowed just 20 minutes. I was the only one allowed to talk. We used to be able to prepare discussion slides. They were not allowed. We only were able to answer questions that you know, the panel had of each of the projects, the projects going forward, not addressing the progress report. So I mean, I think a lot of the preparation here over the next 5 or 6 weeks it will be focused by knowing exactly what's going to happen in that site visit. And I think Sarah Jo can second some of that.
Yeah. And I have, despite several emails, have not received very much detail about.
Yeah.
And we have a new person running this review. One, it's not Buddha anymore. It's Philip something, but yeah. Yeah, Joanne.
Yeah, so this was really helpful to kind of get the overall perspective. And so one thought I had is, in order to talk about a bit more, right? I mean, 20 minutes is so short. For example, what my biomarker and Tina's biomarker, you could have one slide that says we've made progress in biomarkers, and I could redo my slide to be a much to just show two examples of how you can contrast patterns of expression. And Tina could show the volcano plots, and you could say, we have biomarkers in children using two different biomarkers, et cetera. So in one slide with a lot of simplification and some combination, we could You could present a bit more with a bigger overview. What's the point is biomarkers.
Everybody who is going to be in CFAS 5 will see my presentation well before it has to be given and can make comments and things like that.
I mean, that's just a suggestion for if you're looking to be able to present.
It's what we did last time in terms of, you know, we've made progress in this area, this area, this area.
Right.
But there are going to be certain areas that are going to be definitely highlighted because they've really done a significant, made a significant advance. You know, I mean, I could put up a slide, advances in e-health, and, you know, list several things. But, you know, Christy's project may be highlighted, or the telehealth one, telemedicine one, maybe. You know, we have to see, put our best foot forward, stimulate a little interest and excitement among the reviewers.
Right.
And try to, you know, we, in the past, we've had that one slide that kind of shows how, what projects are there and how they interrelate and what they're related to. And we'll have a similar slide. But then we have to kind of, Michael, I, and the SAB will kind of talk about, okay, this is something that is a common theme moving forward, e-health. You want to highlight e-health in some respect. You know, we've got, I mean, just a background slide of how many publications, what grants have spun off. I mean, each of those has to be brought up. So, you know, how we've been successful overall. You know, and I still think that one that shows that if you look at the paper citing prenatal alcohol exposure, the number, 9 of the 10 top investigators in the field are in CFAS. You know, or have been associated with CFAS. I think that says something. So, all righty. Any other comments, concerns, questions? So, yeah, just if you can revise your slides as soon as possible and get them back to me, and then we can move on from there. All right. I'm going to try a little progress. I have to give a talk in another week or 2 weeks. I'm going to try a little. See how it flies. If it stimulates any interest, then go from there.
Ed, do you want to try and practice with Mike again since he's still on?
Mike, you there? You want to try explain your slide? I don't know where you went before. You're muted. I cannot hear a word you're saying.
You're not muted, but we can't hear you.
Your mic is dead.
Maybe your mic's just not connecting.
You're the technical person here, Michael. Come on. Where's Christiana? I don't know what it is, Michael, but people got to go. So
yeah, I got to go.
Try you next time. All right. Thanks. Thanks, everybody.
Bye, everybody. Have fun. This is great. Isn't it fun?
Oh, love it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.